Chapter 29. He accompanied her back to the house. At first they conversed, as if the death of the poor woman was an event which the husband must of necessity deeply lament, and when all under this head, that social form seemed to require had been uttered, they spoke of the material damage done, and of the steps which had better be taken to remedy it. It was not till both were shut inside her private room that she spoke to him in her blunt and cynical manner. A certainness of bearing in him, peculiar to the present morning, had hitherto forbidden her this tone. The demeanor of the subject of her favoritism had altered, she could not tell in what way. He was entirely a changed man. "Are you really sorry for your poor wife, Mr. Manston?" she said. "Well, I am," he answered shortly. "But only as for any human being who has met with a violent death?" He confessed it, for she was not a good woman, he added. "I should be sorry to say such a thing now the poor creature is dead," Miss Aldclyffe returned reproachfully. "Why?" he asked. "Why should I praise her, if she doesn't deserve it? I say exactly what I have often admired Sterne for saying in one of his letters, that neither reason nor scripture asks us to speak nothing but good of the dead. And now, madam," he continued, after a short interval of thought, "I may, perhaps, hope that you will assist me, or rather not thwart me, in endeavoring to win the love of a young lady living about you, one in whom I am much interested already. Cytherea. Yes, Cytherea. You have been loving Cytherea all the while?" Yes. Surprise was a preface to much agitation in her, which caused her to rise from her seat and pace to the side of the room. The steward quietly looked on and added, "I have been loving, and still love her." She came close up to him, wistfully contemplating his face, one hand moving indecisively at her side. "And your secret marriage was, then, the true and only reason for that backwardness regarding the courtship of Cytherea, which, they tell me, has been the talk of the village, not your indifference to her attractions?" Her voice had a tone of conviction in it, as well as of inquiry, but none of jealousy. "Yes," he said, "and not a dishonorable one. What held me back was just that one thing, a sense of morality that perhaps, madam, you did not give me credit for." The latter words were spoken with a mien and tone of pride. Miss Aldclyffe preserved silence. "And now," he went on, "I may as well say a word in vindication of my conduct lately, at the risk, too, of offending you. My actual motive in submitting to your order, that I should send for my late wife, and live with her, was not the mercenary policy of wishing to retain an office which brings me greater comforts than any I have enjoyed before, but this unquenchable passion for Cytherea. Though I saw the weakness, folly, and even wickedness of it continually, it still forced me to try to continue near her, even as the husband of another woman." He waited for her to speak. She did not. "There's a great obstacle to my making any way in winning Miss Gray's love," he went on. "Yes, Edward Springrove," she said quietly. "I know it. I did once want to see them married. They have had a slight quarrel, and it will soon be made up again, unless," she spoke, as if he had only half attended to Manston's last statement. "He is already engaged to be married to somebody else," said the steward. "Pooh," said she, "you mean to his cousin at Peak Hill. That's nothing to help us. He's now come home to break it off." "He must not break it off," said Manston, firmly and calmly. His tone attracted her, startled her. Recovering herself, she said haughtily, "Well, that's your affair, not mine. Though my wish has been to see her, your wife, I can't do anything dishonorable to bring about such a result. But it must be made your affair, he said in a hard, steady voice, looking into her eyes, as if he saw there the whole panorama of her past. One of the most difficult things to portray by written words is that peculiar mixture of moods expressed in a woman's countenance when, after having been sedulously engaged in establishing another's position, she suddenly suspects him of undermining her own. It was thus that Miss Aldcliffe looked at the steward. You know something of me? She faltered. I know all, he said. Then curse that wife of yours. She wrote and said she wouldn't tell you. She burst out. Couldn't she keep her word for a day? She reflected and then said, but no more, as to a stranger, I will not yield. I have committed no crime. I yielded to her threats in a moment of weakness, though I felt inclined to defy her at the time. It was chiefly because I was mystified as to how she got to know of it. Pooh! I will put up with threats no more. Oh, can you threaten me? She added softly, as if he had for the moment forgotten to whom he had been speaking. My love must be made your affair, he repeated, without taking his eyes from her. An agony, which was not the agony of being discovered in a secret, obstructed her utterance for a time. How can you turn upon me so, when I schemed to get you here schemed, that you might win her till I found you were married? Oh, how can you? Oh. She wept, and the weeping of such a nature was as harrowing as the weeping of a man. Your getting me here was bad policy, as to your secret the most absurd thing in the world, he said, not heeding her distress. I knew all, except the identity of the individual, long ago. Directly I found that my coming here was a contrived thing, and not a matter of chance, it fixed my attention upon you at once. All that was required was the mere spark of life, to make of a bundle of perceptions an organic whole. Policy, how can you talk of policy? Think, do think. And how can you threaten me, when you know that I would befriend you readily without a threat? Yes, I think you would, he said more kindly, but your indifference for so many years has made me doubt it. No, not indifference, 'twas enforced silence. My father lived. He took her hand, and held it gently. Now listen, he said, more quietly and humanly, when he had become calmer. Springrove must marry the woman he's engaged to. You may make him, but only in one way. Well, but don't speak sternly, Aeneas. Do you know that his father has not been particularly thriving for the last 2 or 3 years? I have heard something of it, once or twice, though his rents have been promptly paid, haven't they? Oh yes. And do you know the terms of the leases of the houses which are burnt? He said, explaining to her that by those terms she might compel him, even to rebuild every house. The case is the clearest case of fire by negligence that I have ever known. In addition to that, he continued, I don't want them rebuilt. You know it was intended by my father, directly they fell in, to clear the site for a new entrance to the park? Yes, but that doesn't affect the position, which is that Farmer Springrove is in your power to an extent which is very serious for him. I won't do it, is a conspiracy. Won't you for me? He said eagerly. Miss Aldcliffe changed color. I don't threaten now, I implore, he said. Because you might threaten if you chose, she mournfully answered. But why be so when your marriage with her was my own pet idea long before it was yours? What must I do? Scarcely anything. Simply this. When I have seen old Mr. Springrove, which I shall do in a day or two, and told him that he will be expected to rebuild the houses, do you see the young man? See him yourself, in order that the proposals made may not appear to be anything more than an impulse of your own. You or he will bring up the subject of the houses. To rebuild them would be a matter of at least £600, and he will almost surely say that we are hard in insisting upon the extreme letter of the leases. Then tell him that scarcely can you yourself think of compelling an old tenant like his father to any such painful extreme. There shall be no compulsion to build, simply a surrender of the leases. Then speak feelingly of his cousin, as a woman whom you respect and love, and whose secret you have learned to be that she is heartsick with hope deferred. Beg him to marry her, his betrothed and dear friend, as some return for your consideration towards his father. Don't suggest too early a day for their marriage, or he will suspect you of some motive beyond womanly sympathy. Coax him to make a promise to her that she shall be his wife at the end of a twelvemonth, and get him, on assenting to this, to write to Cytherea, entirely renouncing her. ... He has already asked him to do that. ... So much the better, and telling her too, that he is about to fulfill his long-standing promise to marry his cousin. If you think it worthwhile, you may say Cytherea was not indisposed to think of me before she knew I was married. I have at home a note she wrote me the first evening I saw her, which looks rather warm, and which I could show you. Trust me, he will give her up. When he is married to Adelaide Hinton, Cytherea will be induced to marry me perhaps before. A woman's pride is soon wounded. ... And hadn't I better write to Mr. Nyttleton, and inquire more particularly what's the law upon the houses? ... Oh no, there's no hurry for that. We know well enough how the case stands, quite well enough to talk in general terms about it. And I want the pressure to be put upon young Springrove before he goes away from home again. ... She looked at him furtively, long, and sadly, as after speaking he became lost in thought, his eyes listlessly tracing the pattern of the carpet. Yes, yes, she will be mine, ... he whispered, careless of Cytherea Alcliffe's presence. At last he raised his eyes inquiringly. I will do my best, Aeneas, ... she answered. ... Manston then left the house, and again went towards the blackened ruins, where men were still raking and probing. 2. From November the 20th to December the 2nd, the smoldering remnants of the three tranters inn seemed to promise that, even when the searchers should light upon the remains of the unfortunate Mrs. Manston, very little would be discoverable. Consisting so largely of the charcoal and ashes of hard dry oak and chestnut, intermingled with thatch, the interior of the heap was one glowing mass of embers, which, on being stirred about, emitted sparks and flame long after it was dead, and black on the outside. It was persistently hoped, however, that some traces of the body would survive the effect of the hot coals, and after a search pursued uninterruptedly for 30 hours, under the direction of Manston himself, enough was found to set at rest any doubts of her fate. The melancholy gleanings consisted of her watch, bunch of keys, a few coins, and 2 charred and blackened bones. 2 days later the official inquiry into the cause of her death was held at the Rising Sun Inn, before Mr. Floyd, the coroner, and a jury of the chief inhabitants of the district. The little tavern, the only remaining one in the village, was crowded to excess by the neighboring peasantry as well as their richer employers. All who could by any possibility obtain an hour's release from their duties, being present as listeners. The jury viewed the sad and infinitesimal remains, which were folded in a white cambric cloth, and laid in the middle of a well-finished coffin lined with white silk by Manston's order, which stood in an adjoining room, the bulk of the coffin being completely filled in with carefully arranged flowers, and evergreens also the steward's own doing. Abraham Brown, of Hoxton, London, an old white-headed man, without the ruddiness which makes white hair so pleasing, was sworn, and deposed that he kept a lodging house at an address he named. On the Saturday evening less than a month before the fire, a lady came to him, with very little luggage, and took the front room on the second floor. He did not inquire where she came from, as she paid a week in advance, but she gave her name as Mrs. Manston, referring him, if he wished for any guarantee of her respectability, to Mr. Manston, Knapwater Park. Here she lived for 3 weeks, rarely going out. She slept away from her lodgings one night during the time. At the end of that time, on the 28th of November, she left his house in a four-wheeled cab, about 12 o'clock in the day, telling the driver to take her to the Waterloo station. She paid all her lodging expenses, and not having given notice the full week previous to her going away, offered to pay for the next, but he only took half. She wore a thick black veil and gray waterproof cloak when she left him, and her luggage was two boxes, one of plain deal, with black japanned clamps, the other sewn up in canvas. Joseph Chinney, porter at the Carriford Road station, deposed that he saw Mrs. Manston, dressed as the last witness had described, get out of a second-class carriage on the night of the 28th. She stood beside him whilst her luggage was taken from the van. The luggage, consisting of the clamp deal box and another covered with canvas, was placed in the cloak room. She seemed at a loss at Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.